As the title slide I mentioned a moment ago indicates, you know, actually in the midst of Ezra, Ezra, as I've mentioned in previous classes, divides into two very distinct parts, and there's years between those two parts. In fact, Ezra doesn't even appear in the first part. And so, since we have three returns from captivity, three times that the Jews are coming back from their exile that began with Nebuchadnezzar, will last for 70 years, and are now coming back, particularly to be rebuilding the temple. Ezra's first six chapters cover roughly the 20 years from 538 BC to 516. And this is when Zerubbabel is the governor, and he is responsible for this first return and the beginning of rebuilding the temple. But after a few years, the temple work is stopped. They meet some opposition. There's a bunch of political stuff that goes on, which we've already studied. And so the work is stopped and will not be resumed until and finished until 520 and then 516. So it's going to take about 4 years to actually build the temple at the end, but in 16 years, then it just lay there with nothing but a foundation. So between these years here, you can see down at the bottom that the prophets Haggai and Zechariah are both involved in getting the people started to rebuilding of the temple that had been lying dormant now for 16 years. So it's a great chart. I'm not going to go through all the figures here. You got King's Persia in the north, but just to see the general time frame, we're in this break right now between Ezra 6 ending about 516 BC. Esther's going to fit in here as well, and then we'll have chapters 7 through 10 for the single year of about 457, considerably later, to finish up the book of Ezra. So, on a Sunday night, we read six chapters of Zechariah without interruption, so that everybody can kind of just get this material under your belt. In a previous Ezra class, we also looked at Haggai, which is a really tiny little minor prophet, only two chapters. So we've covered Haggai. We looked at the first chapter last week of Zechariah. And we're just going to start over again with Zechariah tonight and finish these first six chapters now, which comprise one section in Zechariah as well. So more on that in a second, but just to see where we are. In Ezra chapter 4 and verse 24, work on the house of God in Jerusalem ceased, and it was stopped until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. This second year of Darius, which is 520 BC, is a really busy year. So we have Haggai's prophecy designated as having been written in that time frame. We also have Zechariah saying the same thing. There are several prophecies, in fact, between the two of them that are dated to this second year of the reign of the king of Persia. And in chapter 5 now, verse 1 and 2, when the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, then Zerubbabel and Jeshua arose and began to rebuild the house of God which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So, we've had 16 years, things have been lying idle, coming down to 520 BC, time to get to work again, need 4 more years to finish it. And the specific designation of Haggai and Zechariah now in chapter 5 of Ezra as being the ones appointed by God to get them started. With regard to Zechariah, we saw again last week that very little is known about this man beyond the fact that it's a really popular name. There are 27 different Zecharias in the Old Testament. So this is the one who lived in this year, the second year of Darius, but among many, and about him, his life, we are just told essentially nothing. We have, however, in Zechariah's book, the largest of the minor prophets. Minor prophets are designated that as opposed to major prophets solely because of the size of the book, how big the books are. And then we have an exception. He's actually bigger than Daniel, and so kind of misnamed maybe as it is. But it is not just a very large book by everybody's estimation. It's also one of, many people would contend, the single most difficult book to comprehend, to understand, to interpret, because it is so full of symbology as to what exactly it's talking about. The early going's easier than the later, and we'll get through that early going here this evening. And he is dated right between Haggai chapter 2, verse 9, and Haggai chapter 2, verse 10. So right there, we have Haggai's prophecies being dated. He's giving us a series of months in this same second year of Darius, and that's how Zechariah begins as well, in a different month in the midst of those months in that second year. So, we pointed out last week as well, coming to the end of our review, that really though, for 14 full chapters, there's essentially only two things on his mind. There's a tiny little bit of an exception we'll see later, but really there's only two things on Zechariah's mind for 14 chapters. Number one, we saw it in Ezra, we've seen it in this first chapter already. What is he there to make happen? Get the temple finished. The people have been building their own houses. Is that a good idea? While the Lord's lies fallow, no, it's not. Time for them to get the Lord's built as well. And then secondly, this is a profoundly messianic book. Throughout this book, you'll see it several times tonight, he then looks beyond the physical building of this temple to the creation of a different temple in a different kingdom under a different king. And beyond all doubt, that king is Jesus the Christ, Son of the living God. So he is moving the people like Haggai to build that temple. But he is especially, and rivaled only by Isaiah, which John just finished teaching over there in the hinterlands, I understand, as I did here not too long ago, rivaled only by Isaiah for being so just chock full of messianic prophecy. So we'll be seeing both of those things in his book. Now, for new material, I did not give you an outline last week of Zechariah. So, if you like, grab a pencil or pen if you got a fair amount of blank space somewhere. Let me give you this outline. It's really easy in the beginning because the first six chapters are the night of the eight visions. There are eight separate visions, one immediately on the heels of the other, that take place in these first six chapters. We finished the first chapter last week, touch on it here in a moment, but eight visions that will be in this single night. So poor Zechariah is really overwhelmed with what he sees. Then there's a very curious little section of two chapters, chapters 7 and 8, which are kind of easy to get confused in because chapter 7 begins with a question about fasting. And then the answer is so lengthy that it's really hard to recognize that it's really all about this same topic, clear down to the very end of chapter 8, where finally you can see the question is being answered. So it kind of feels like he wandered away, which he certainly didn't, but it's easy to get lost in the answer and not recognize it's two chapters that we'll call the question of fasting. Great amount of elaboration in the process of answering that question. Then we have two more sections that are a little more awkward. They're not so clearly defined. The first seven verses of chapter 9 verses 1 through 7, are a judgment on a whole laundry list of surrounding Gentile nations. And it really stands out as unusual in the midst of this book, because really the whole rest of the book doesn't do anything like that. So there's this brief interlude of just seven verses where God now wants to reveal about these surrounding nations. It's real simple. They're going to be destroyed. They will be paid back for their misbehavior. But there's a judgment on the Gentile nations in those first seven verses of chapter 9. And then from verse 8 of chapter 9 all the way to the last verse of chapter 11, which is the 17th verse, from 9:8 through 11:17, we have a messianic prophecy that is about a future king. And so it's pretty clearly discussed in there that while there are mirror images in the physical world about current government, we're really looking toward the fulfillment of an ultimate and future king in a far better government. And then we have the end of the book. Chapters 12 through 14 are apparently one prophecy. It's called the Burden of Israel. And that prophecy that is very messianic, and in fact is quoted in the New Testament with regard to the crucifixion of Jesus. So for a book that is designed to motivate the people to build their temple, It is as much about the future temple, as we concluded last week's lesson, as it is about the current physical one. What is, in their time frame, the future temple going to be like? It is, in two letters, us. Okay, it's the spiritual kingdom, and so it's us. We are now the new temple in which God dwells. And so Zechariah, while he is writing clear back in the 500s BC, is being very specific about the coming of one who is yet half a millennium away. So, last week, in Zechariah chapter 1, we had a lot of fun just trying to figure out how to count to 3 or 4. And I suggested, you know, most people say it's about 4 horses, of which 2 are red, and they're down in a low spot, kind of like a slough, you'd think, in among the myrtle trees. And then we have 2, then, that would be red. We have sorrel, and then we have this white horse as well. Number one vision is the horseman among the myrtle trees, and it's interpreted for us. So without trying to get into colors of the horses and how many there are, maybe there's only 3, maybe there's 4, it really doesn't matter to us. We have an interpretation. They've been riding everywhere, and what's the report? All is peaceful and quiet. So, my house will be built. As the book begins, the very first prophecy in this wondrous night of 8 prophecies says, there's no trouble, so get to building. There's no trouble also means there's no excuses. You got no reason to not be building on this temple. So that one is interpreted for us really very easily. We see the imagery. We are tempted to want to get real particular, but God never does. So it doesn't matter about the color of the horses, I don't think, because he doesn't explain that. What we are told is, all is peaceful and quiet, build my house. Then we have, number 2, the vision of the 4 horns and the 4 craftsmen. Probably should have pointed out. Vision number 1, if you're scanning your Bible there, is Zechariah chapter 1, verses 8 through 17. So if you want to make the note, or bracket those verses somehow, vision number 1 in this night is chapter 1, verses 8 through 17. The second vision, much shorter, is chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. So you can scan that. We talked about it last week. But what we're told is we have 4 horns and we have 4 craftsmen. The horns, yes, they could be an animal's horns. They could be an ox's horns. Yes, the craftsman could be working then, you know, with some kind of, they suggest a planer here, that would be able to shape and form, you know, horn material of an animal. But, as I pointed out, there is a very different, and I think at least as much used, idea or concept that's attached to horns, and that is these cornerstones. This is a replica, but very precise, and on-site in Beth Shan, of a Canaanite altar that had 4 horns on it. Both the Canaanites and the Jews are renowned for having 4 horns on their altars. The place of sacrifice had horns on the corner. It appears, because we're finding them from the time frame, that they're not animal horns. They are carvings of stone that look like this quite a few times, in fact, that we've uncovered, you know, they've uncovered, I'm not an archaeologist, but have found through the years. And so, in the end, we have really a very simple interpretation for this one as well. Those who scattered Judah will be thrown down. They're going to pay for it. So, it doesn't matter to me, and it isn't explained, so we can't know. Maybe he's looking at these kind of horns. Maybe he's looking at those kind of horns. Maybe he's looking at these kind of craftsmen. Maybe he's looking at stonemasons. We don't know. But we do know what it means. What's it mean? Those who scattered Judah will be thrown down. So that's the interpretation. And now I know, you know what to make out of it at least. Vision number 3 is of a man measuring Israel. So tonight, we're going to take new material. Vision number 3 is chapter 2, all 13 verses. So now we're getting a much lengthier vision. The third of the eight sounds like this. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a man with a measuring line in his hand. We'd say a tape measure. So I said, "Where are you going?" And he said to me, "To measure Jerusalem to see how wide it is and how long it is." And behold, the angel who was speaking with me was going out, and another angel was coming out to meet him and said to him, "Run, speak to that young man, saying, Jerusalem will be inhabited without walls because of the multitude of men and cattle within it." Now let me stop there for just a second. The vision is of an individual who's going to measure Jerusalem. But again, in the imagery, we learn because it's so big, because of the multitudes of people and animals that are in it. So already we're being given some kind of information about how to understand this vision. Jerusalem is going to be inhabited, and it won't even have walls because of the multitude. So the idea is, you guys who are living in this area, which does not have any walls around the city area at all, which barely has anything you could call a city, though you have been building your houses when you should have been building the Lord's house. And now I'm getting you, up and moving to build the Lord's temple right here. You need to understand that when all is said and done, Jerusalem, as well as this temple, are going to be rebuilt. It's going to be huge. It's going to be so big it'd be hard to even put walls around it now for all the people and the cattle. Verse 5, "For I declares the Lord will be a wall of fire around her, and I will be the glory in her midst. Ho there, flee from the land of the north, declares Yahweh, for I have dispersed you as the four winds of the heavens, declares the Lord. Ho, Zion, escape, you who are living with the daughter of Babylon. For thus says Yahweh of hosts, after glory he has sent me against the nations which plunder you. For he who touches you touches the apple of his eye." If you ever wonder where that expression comes from, there it is. Now, who among us knows it when they use it today? But there it is. Verse 9, "For behold, I will wave my hand over them so that they will be plunder for their slaves. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me. Sing for joy. Be glad, O daughter of Zion. For behold, I am coming and I will dwell in your midst, declares Yahweh. And many nations..." Note the plurality, which is so extremely significant in the Old Testament. Anytime you see nation in the plural, "the nations will join themselves to the Lord in that day and will become my people." Why is the plural form of nations so significant in the Old Testament? Because it's over against the singular, and the singular refers to what nation? The Jews. And the plurality then is everybody else, which we call Gentiles. So the very thought in the prophecy that all the Gentiles are going to come and join themselves to you, which after what they've just been told would suggest is part of the reason why the city is so big. But that because of the multitude of the animals and the people living in this city, I, God, will be a wall of fire. I become your protector within this vision. So in 11, "many nations will join themselves to the Lord in that day and will become my people. Then I will dwell in your midst. You will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you, and the Lord will possess Judah as his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. Be silent, all flesh, before Yahweh, for he is aroused from his holy habitation." So, what is the prophecy about? Well, brethren, again, we've seen this at least twice already. you can see in the people's minds and in the people's circumstances from their viewpoint, and at that time, we've been told in Ezra, we've been told in Haggai, we've already been told in Zechariah. What are they to be doing in their time right now? Built like crazy. But again, we've seen now several times, and God then looks down through centuries to come at the fruit of what you're doing here, and of something that is grander and larger, and for them in their current circumstances, essentially unthinkable. A time when all of the Gentiles will be united with the Jews in a Judah and Jerusalem that is one people protected by the very fire of God. So it's just an astonishing kind of a prophecy for them. Would they get the point? We better get our shovels and our hammers and our nails out, you know, and carving stones and stacking them up and building a temple. Yes. But I think it's also unavoidable for them to recognize. But there's something else going on here. Something bigger than what we're doing right now. And strange and alien to our ears. That all the nations would be involved. These people, 500 years before the fulfillment, would no doubt be somewhat confused by all of this. You know, what? But it sure have their attention. It's still, though, it's really not a hard prophecy, is it? It is essentially interpreted for us, and for those that have the advantage of all these years later, you know, seeing an entire New Testament to explain it all, really not difficult at all. This is a preeminently messianic prophecy that is grown as an extension out of the immediate physical work that these people need to do. Type and antitype, figure and substance, shadow and reality. These are terms that are used throughout Scripture, and here is just one of the best places to see it being played out. Now comes vision number four. Vision number four is in chapter 3 and the whole chapter. A little shorty, just 10 verses. But vision 4 is chapter 3. And you can see the flow. Then, well, there's no break. Then, after what's already been 3 visions, then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of Yahweh, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. Now, you got to know what that reminds you of. Satan standing accusing someone. Job. There's Job again, isn't it? Very curious to see is effectively the very same setup that you have in the opening verses of the book of Job, which makes one think, how often did Satan stand to accuse known actual living people down on earth as to whether or not they were living up to God's expectations for them? There's a fuller discussion in Job, in a whole book ultimately that's devoted to it, but here it's just Job all over again. So in verse 2, the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. Indeed, the Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?" Now, that's an expression that's also used more than once in your Bible, but it's easy enough to figure out. What is a brand, and don't think branding iron or cattle, what is a brand that's plucked from the fire physically? What does plucked suggest? Snatched, and it's done quickly, and it's done what? Purposely. Because ordinarily, branches and fire belong together. So I'm going to snatch one out of there. There's got to be some reason, some value. It's kind of an unusual thing, but the idea is you're actually kind of exposing yourself to some danger and pain to get down into that fire enough that you can grab that brand and pull it out of there. Now, brand, think branch, but you're pulling something out of the fire. So, this is what Joshua is. He is something that's rescued. He is something that is saved. He's been snatched back out of what would ordinarily consume him. But he's rescued. Now, in 3, Joshua, highly unusual for a high priest, again, for Jews, unthinkable, was clothed with filthy garments and standing before the angel. And he spoke and said to those who were standing before him, saying, remove the filthy garments from him. Again he said to him, see, I have taken your iniquity away from you and will clothe you with festal robes. Then I said, let them put a clean turban on his head. So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments while the angel of the Lord was standing by. And the angel of the Lord admonished Joshua, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts, if you will walk in my ways, and if you will perform my service, then you will also govern my house, and also have charge of my courts, and I will grant you free access among these who are standing here. Now listen, Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who are sitting in front of you, indeed, they are men who are a symbol. For behold, I am going to bring in my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I have set before Joshua, on one stone are 7 eyes. Behold, I will engrave an inscription on it, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to sit under his vine and under his fig tree. Now, there's a lot of stuff in there. Very interesting group of people in Jerusalem who are known as the Temple Institute. It's written right here, but you can't see it. And they are a collection of, self-identified Jews who are extremely intent and on occasion can cause some trouble in Jerusalem with rebuilding a temple there so that Jews can reestablish the religion of old, including having new set of priests with the high priest over them, that they might actually offer animal sacrifices again on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The Muslims don't care for this idea. In fact, a lot of Jews don't care for it either. A lot of tension, that results from it. But their website and the photographs that they have, the illustrations like this, are really interesting because they are a people like few others that have dedicated their whole lives for a long time now to the study of the Old Testament sacrificial system. So when they come up, as you can see, this is actually in Hebrew here, when they come up with these illustrations, they're doing what I would deem to be the best job possible today. Sympathetic Jews reading their own text and saying, this is what we think it should look like. And in fact, they are weaving, creating, building menorahs and all the rest of it in preparation. They firmly believe, pray constantly for this day to come, and they're going to be totally ready. They'll have the garments for the high priest. They'll have the garments for the other priests. They're building, the altar and all the parts that go in the temple, the table of showbread, everything. They're building, and then you'll see photographs and or illustrations of that material. So here's about as good a representation of what a high priest would look like as you can ever see. And it is one, then, that is all about purity, cleanliness, and being holy. That means set apart for the service of God. For a high priest to have the tiniest little speck of a drop of dirt on him would render him what? Defiled, unfit. Could he do anything in the temple? Nothing. So to have filthy garments on him, that is a picture of the defilement, inadequacy, sinfulness and or punishment, destruction, that is prohibiting these people from being able to worship and serve their God as they ought. Now back in Zechariah's time, he's moving them to rebuild the temple. It'll be four more years before they do it, but now comes this vision. And then in the midst of the vision, all we get at length is, take all the filthy stuff off and what? Put clean stuff on, because I have removed your iniquity. Behold, I have removed your iniquity. So now, the high priest has been sanctified again. He is prepared again to lead the people in God's sacrificial system. This would be most encouraging for a people who have a foundation but need to do what? Build the temple so that this man can do the work. So that part's really easy. And then we come down to this one statement. You know, so Joshua, the branch, and the removal of iniquity in a day is what this is all about. But the branch is a single verse. So we just have this statement. Listen, is verse 8. Now listen, Joshua the high priest. You and your friends who are sitting in front of you, they are men who are a symbol, for behold, I'm going to bring in my servant the branch. They are a symbol about somehow the branch. They got something to do with the branch. Now, if you weren't here in Isaiah, or actually I've done this as a standalone sermon as well, but if you don't have the collection of verses in your Old Testament on the branch, get your pencil out. So here they are. This is a theme that you will find introduced chronologically by Isaiah in chapter 4 and verse 2. We've looked at it in two different contexts here in recent months or years, so I'm not going back. Just note, it's Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2. Then you have it also again in the first 10 verses of Isaiah 11. So twice in the book of Isaiah, this branch pops up. Then in Jeremiah chapter 23, verses 5 and following, and again in Jeremiah 33, verses 14 through 18. So it was a longer number of verses in chapter 23, but in 33, it's just the 4, 14 through 18, 5. But twice in Isaiah, twice in Jeremiah. Now here we have Zechariah chapter 3 and verse 8. This is what we're talking about. It'll come up again before this night is over in our last chapter for the evening at verses 12 and 13. Now again, there are those who would try to make some kind of significance out of twice in Isaiah, twice in Jeremiah, twice in Zechariah. Well, I see that, but there's nothing in Scripture that would teach us what to do with it. So call it coincidental, call it unrelated, happenstance, call it highly significant, but we don't know what the significance is. You know, call it what you will, but that's it. It's Isaiah in the 700s B.C. It's Jeremiah in the 600s B.C. And it's Zechariah in the 500s B.C., three succeeding centuries, that are going to speak about this branch. And beyond all conceivable doubt, we went through it in the other classes, no time for it now, read it yourself, you will not disagree. Who is the branch? Jesus the Christ and none other. So Joshua, you who have had all your filthy garments in the vision removed, and you have all the purified garments put upon you, you and the men that are in front of you, you are symbols. And it's about this branch. Now, it's about Jesus. So just take note. What I'm doing with you guys in the vision is somehow about the branch. Joshua in this vision is symbolic of the branch. Just tuck that thought away, as we will be coming back to it in a minute. So now let's go to vision number 5. In vision number 5, it's chapter 4. Again, tiny chapter. Again, the whole chapter encompasses the entire vision. Vision number 5 is the 14 verses of chapter 4. There's a lampstand, and there's two olive trees. Now, brother, we do not know what this looked like, but I think that's a really great representation. Olive trees are very strange by our standards. They're very odd looking by our standards. And they are very long lived. They can live for centuries. If some of them in Israel, they'll point out that tree is 400 years old. Wow, that is amazing. And so they get to be really thick, not very tall. They're very bush-like, a little well overhead, you know, but they also are very rough and gnarly and pitted. It's just a very unique kind of a bark, very unique kind of a tree, and a pretty fair representation of the two that you have right there. But what, you know, what size is the lampstand? What size is the bowl? How do we get, you know, the oil to flow and all the rest of that? Nobody knows but Zechariah. So this is as good a guess as I get. But what you've got apparently is two olive trees on either side of what the Jews would call a menorah. And then these lamps that are on, these seven lamps that are on this lampstand are being fed by an oil that is somehow a bowl of oil that is being resupplied by these two trees. Well, it took me 40 minutes to get that first cough. That's not too bad.
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay, so what is it about? Well, I'll tell you in advance and then we'll read it. Zerubbabel is going to finish that temple. Zerubbabel is the leader of the first return of the Jews from Babylonian captivity. Now the Medo-Persians have captured Babylon. Zerubbabel's the governor who's led these people. Now he's there, and he's the guy that got them starting to build, and yet they failed for 16 years, and he's still governor. He's going to finish it. So he's going to finish the temple, and then we're going to find out about two anointed ones. So we'll talk about them in a minute, but that's the vision. Vision number five. Two olive trees, the lampstand, the bowl, and the oil that's flowing from the trees to feed the fire of the lampstands. So let's read chapter 4. Then, the angel who was speaking with me returned and roused me as a man who is awakened from his sleep. And he said to me, "What do you see?" And I said, "I see, and behold, a lampstand all of gold with its bowl on the top of it, and its seven lamps on it, with seven spouts belonging to each of the lamps which are on the top of it. Also, two olive trees by it, one on the right side of the bowl, the other on its left side." Then I answered and said to the angel who was speaking with me, saying, "What are these, my Lord?" So the angel who was speaking with me answered and said to me, "Do you not know what these are?" Now, I've read it that way because, it kind of sounds like he had an expectation that he ought to. I'm not sure that's the case, though. So maybe just focus attention. You don't know, and that's right. So make sure you remember you didn't know. You didn't get this idea out of your own head. I'm going to tell you. But whichever it is, he answered and said in verse 6, "This is the word of Yahweh to Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says Yahweh of hosts. What are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you will become a plain, and he will bring forth the top stone with shouts of grace, grace to it." Also, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, "The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will finish it. Then you will know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me to you. For who has despised the day of small things? But these seven will be glad when they see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel." So in the seven are, he now explains, "The eyes of the Lord which range to and fro throughout the earth." We had seven eyes on a stone earlier. We have seven eyes of the Lord ranging now. We've got seven eyes of the Lord in other places. It's all very curious. Don't quite know what to make out of it. But in 11, I answered and said to him, "What are these two olive trees on the right of the lampstand and on its left?" And I answered the second time and said to him, "What are the two olive branches which are beside the two golden pipes which empty the golden oil from themselves?" So he answered me, saying, "Do you not know what these are?" I said, "No, my Lord." Then he said, "These are the two anointed ones who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth." Now, we have already been told, what does the vision mean? Zerubbabel started this temple and He'll finish it. So that's the first thing. He started it. He's going to finish it. It is in verse 9. The hands of Zerubbabel laid the foundation of this house. His hands will finish it. But he's also told us something prior to that statement that is tremendously important. Before that statement in verse 7, he said, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit." Well, what? Not by might or power, but by my spirit. You got to wait a few verses. You started this temple, you're going to finish this temple. But what has he already told them? You started it, you'll finish it. But it's not by your might. It's not by your power. You'll start and you'll finish. Who's going to see that it gets done? The Spirit of the living God. So the temple will be rebuilt. Zerubbabel is going to be on both the beginning and the end. That's what the vision means. Then in verse 10, we are given a third bit of information about Zerubbabel's finishing the temple. Who has despised the day of small things? That makes a great sermon. I've preached that sermon. A lot of guys have preached that sermon. There's just a thousand ways you can go with a line like that in preaching. Okay? Every congregation starts what? Small, and don't despise it. I have no idea where it's going to go with God's Spirit and not by your might and by your power. There's a typical way that you would use the line. This is about finishing the temple. Zerubbabel will do it. It's not by his own might or power. It's by the Spirit. And don't you despise its what? This temple's size. This is the principal reason that people think in Ezra that when the older people who had seen the temple before it was destroyed, those who had lived in the last days of Solomon's temple, who lived through the whole Babylonian captivity of 70 years and came back to see the size of the foundation that was laid and then wept, this is the principal verse they used to say that they wept out of sorrow, out of grief, not out of joy. And it may be. That may be the case. It has been 16 years since then. And so, I'm not sure if these two should even be connected. But in this passage, at least, it's being clarified for us. Apparently, somebody has despised the day of small things. And they're being told what about that? Don't. Just don't. So in the context, it does seem apparent. You're thinking things are a lot smaller than they used to be. Well, quit thinking that. It's not by your might or power. It is by my Holy Spirit. Zerubbabel began that thing. Whether you despise how small it is or not, he's going to finish that temple as well. Problem is, what are we going to do with verses 12 and 13 and 14? Second time said to him, "What are the two olive branches beside the two golden pipes and the golden oil?" So he answered, said, "You know what these are?" I said, "No." And he said, "These are the two anointed ones who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth." There are two who have been anointed, one and the other, represented by these trees. They are the two anointed ones, and they're standing by the Lord of all the earth. Who are they? Now, I will suggest, because I read it in Homer Haley's commentary, okay, not because it's my own idea in this case, but I'm pretty sure that he's going to be right about this. Who are the two anointed ones? Well, what he's done, I think, is brilliant, very wise. He has first taken note that in the whole chapter prior to the one we're reading now, who was the figure in the vision? Joshua the high priest. And what do we do with Joshua the high priest? Cleanse him and put the new garments on him, forgive him of all sin, and set him up so that he can officiate in the temple again. Okay? What do you do at the last so that you inaugurate a priest for service? What do you do to him? you anoint him. He is anointed with oil. Blessed is the oil flows down Aaron's beard in the psalm. Okay? So there's an anointed one in the whole third chapter. And then what did we just spend this chapter on? Zerubbabel. Now, there is a bit of an anomaly here. Zerubbabel, is he a king? No, he is a governor. He is not a king. He's a governor. But we found out in chapter 3, Joshua and his men were symbolic of something else, weren't they? They were symbolic of the branch, and the branch is Jesus. Now, we've got two anointed ones over here. And you're going to rebuild this temple, Zerubbabel. But what do you do with kings to inaugurate them? Set them in office. You anoint them as well. And Jesus, the branch, in the preceding vision of these eight, we just finished reading it, Jesus is the only one who will ever be both a priest and a king. As a matter of fact, and thirdly, he will also be an anointed one. What's another kind of anointing? Prophet, priest, and king. It's prophet, priest, and king. He'll be all three. Okay, so who are these two anointed ones standing by the Lord? Well, I agree with Homer. The best, you know, that I think anybody can sort out here is this is a picture of Zerubbabel and Joshua, the governor and the priest's responsibility to support in the building of this temple, a primary feature of which inside that temple is a what? A seven-branched candlestick holder, or lampstand holder. So it just seems to be symbolic of the fact that the temple will be built, and Joshua and Zerubbabel are the two main players. That's what chapters 3 and 4 are about. Now, vision number 6 is really pretty simple and also a little confusing, I guess, but it's only 4 verses. But in chapter 5, in the first 4 verses, then I lifted up my eyes again and looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll. He said to me, "What do you see?" I answered, "I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits. That'd be 30, 32, 34 feet, something like that. And its width is 10 cubits, so 15, 16, 17 feet. And he said to me, "This is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely everyone who steals will be purged away, according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears," and we will find later, swears falsely in the next verse, "everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side. And I'll make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts. It will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timber and stones." End of prophecy. What does that mean? Well, the only thing we're told is that the thieves and the liars are cursed and will be destroyed along with their houses. Now, that's all the more I know to make out of it. It would be quite a warning to these people, though. Now, I'm pretty sure that other sins will also be punished. So it's a little quizzical, you know, why only these two, thieves and liars? You know, there'd be a lot of questions that would arise. I can't answer those questions in these four verses. Zechariah didn't do it, and that's because God didn't do it. Don't know anywhere else to go. Bill, what do you got?
Wouldn't this be a very apt description of the people that were in Jerusalem when it was destroyed? They falsely swore to God, and they were the thieves of God's religion.
Yeah, but that's all past, and it's 70 years ago. In fact, it's 86 years ago now. And
well,
and so I don't, this is a future thing, is what it appears to be. And so it's hard.
Well, I mean in 70.
Oh, that far ahead. Okay, well, again, that may be the case if you look to a future, you know, judgment that would be in the far distant future and another 40 years farther even than Jesus and his crucifixion. So, okay. Good guess. But is there any way to confirm it? See, no. So there may be a dozen ways we could say, wouldn't this work? And you would say, yeah, I could see how, but we just don't have a confirmation. So maybe you got it, and we'll never know. You have to ask later. Okay, so I just have to pass on that one. I haven't got an answer for you. Then we got this neat seventh vision right here. So vision 7 is verses 5 through 11, the second half of chapter 5. Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes, see what this is going forth. I said, what is it? He said, it's the ephod going forth. Again he said, this is their appearance in all the land. And behold, a lead cover was lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the ephod. He said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down in the middle of the ephod, cast the lead weight on its opening. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there were two women who were coming out with the wind in their wings. And they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the ephod between the earth and the heavens. I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking the ephod? And then he said to me, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar. And when it is prepared, she'll be set there on her own pedestal. So what does that mean? Well, brethren, you know, I'm not sure. It looks pretty related to the preceding vision right there. Wickedness is going to be contained, but it's given apparently a temple in some translations, you know, a pedestal. But Shinar is far away and it's Gentile territory. It is a picture then of wickedness that is being what? Stuffed down in a basket, and then we do what? Put a lead weight on it, okay? And then we have these women who fly in with stork's wings and they fly it away into a far distant land. What did we do with Joshua in chapter 3? Forgave Moses' iniquity, took it away, dressed him in the proper robes. What are we doing here to what appears to be the whole land? Well, after the preceding six visions curse upon liars and thieves, we have wickedness entirely banished from the land. It's the best I can do with it. Now, I've got 3 minutes to do the whole chapter. Let's roll. I lifted up my eyes again in chapter 6, looked, behold, four chariots coming forth from between two mountains, and the mountains were bronze. First chariot, red horses, second chariot, black horses, third chariot, white horses, fourth chariot, strong, dappled horses. Then I spoke and said to the angel who was speaking with me, what are these, my Lord? And the angel answered and said to me, these are the four spirits of heaven, going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white ones go forth after them, while the dappled ones go forth to the south country. When the strong ones went out, they were eager to go to patrol the earth. And he said, go, patrol the earth. So they patrolled the earth. And then he cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, see those who are going to the land of the north, and that was two chariots, have appeased my wrath in the land of the north. The word of the Lord also came to me saying, now before we go any farther, this ninth verse is a totally different thing and it's not even a vision. So what is that about? Vision number 8. It just looks like God is saying, the nations that have punished you will be punished. My wrath will be appeased on them. That sounds like the horns and the craftsmen again. That's what it sounds like. But, brethren, you know, what can we say about it? I don't know. Go to 9 through 15. The word of the Lord also came to me saying, and this is the word of the Lord now and not a vision, take an offering from the exiles, from Heldai, Tobijah, and Jediah. These are actual living people. Go the same day, enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah, where they have arrived from Babylon. Take silver and gold, make a crown, set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Then say to him, thus says Yahweh of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch, for he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of Yahweh. Yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he who will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. which because of tribal designations is impossible for Joshua to do. He's from the wrong tribe. But still he's involved. Thus, he will be a priest on his throne. Not Joshua, but the branch. And the council of peace will be between the two offices. Now, the crown will become a reminder in the temple of the Lord to Helam, Tobijah, Jediah, and him, the son of Zephaniah. Those who are far off will come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you'll know the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. It'll take place if you completely obey the Lord your God. They made an actual crown. They made this physical crown out of silver and of gold. They set it on the head of Joshua, which would be very inappropriate for a priest to have a king's crown. And then, apparently, they took it right back off of him, and they kept it as a memorial of the branch who would spread out. And he's going to build the temple. In the eight visions, who were we told was going to build the temple? Zerubbabel. But now, Joshua is symbolic of somebody else who's going to build the temple. And that guy is going to be what? He's going to be a priest and a king. A priest on his throne. That's a messianic prophecy now, isn't it? Nighty-night.